Cascadia and the edge of the world, Euphemet presents Night Drift with Jim Perry.
Good evening, I'm Jim Perry, and you are listening to Night Drift, presented by Euphemet. Broadcasting this week from my home studio in the hinterlands of the Oregon coast to our mothership, the studio of 1150 AM KKNW in Seattle, and worldwide at nightdrift.com. Tonight, Nathan Paul Isaac will join us for the entire program. His podcast, Penny Royal, returned last week with a second season, and it's all about high strangeness on the Penny Royal Plateau, the magic and mystery of place, this one, a dark and bloody ground, a history of the brutally anomalous, both magical and human. That's tonight. It's going to be a great conversation with Nathan. Also returning this week was Euphemet, the podcast, my podcast, the documentary series. It's back. And this week, a story about a girl named Caitlin. She escaped her small town only to be followed by something else. And thank you for listening, the messages, the excitement around this new season. A new episode will be released shortly, if not next week, the week after, on the Euphemet feed. The reason being, I moved the show to a new platform and the ad program haven't quite kicked in yet, causing our production timeline to hit just a tiny snag as we set upon a very ambitious schedule this year. We'll keep you posted over on social media at Euphemet. And next tonight is Nathan Isaac on Penny Royal. And we'll also be taking your calls tonight, 425-373-5527, or toll-free in Western Washington, that's 888-298-5569, on Night Drift, right after this.
I've been drifting on the sea of heartbreak, trying to get myself ashore for so long. For so long, listening to the strangest stories, wondering where it all went wrong. For so long, for so long. But hold on, hold on, hold on to what you got.
Follow the show on social media at Euphemet, Euphemet.
You drive through a pool of gore and you turn around and you see you're making tracks on the road with blood. Coyote blood. It's one of the many statements made in the Penny Royal series that is cutting, telling, and exposes you to the nakedness of a strange, strange place and its violent history. Out front of your headlights on a dusty road. Then an outsider came to the county, this county in Kentucky, and discovered it had some weird stuff occurring. Living witnesses to monsters, occult origins, bodies buried. Later, surrounded by a few friends, they dug into the weird history of this place, of these people, of the Penny Royal Plateau. Nathan Paul Isaac is a writer, filmmaker, and host creator of the Penny Royal podcast, a native of Kentucky. He has been researching the folklore, mystery, and high strangeness of the Bluegrass State for over two decades. In addition to the Penny Royal podcast, Nathan films and produces the music series Sommer Sessions. Nathan, welcome back to Night Drift.
Oh, Jim, man, thanks so much for having me back.
I got so many comments from your last appearance on the show we did just 2 weeks ago, and I'm welcoming you back with as little hyperbole as possible, my friend, as I think a lot of people are excited to hear from you, and a lot of people are listening to Penny Royal. So last time you described to me the weird signs and graffiti that started popping up downtown after the debut of your first season, and you sent me the photos. I'll, with your permission, I'll share those when this thing is posted to the feed. But But for now, you know, an example, someone spray painted on a roof, this town is a cult.
Right. Yeah.
So season two debuted last week. Did anything happen this time?
No. So far, nothing. Right. It's been weird in a different way. Two episodes have released. We're doing one episode a week, and you know, the first episode was sort of just laying the groundwork for what the season was going to be, and you know, and that's how the first season unfolded. That's how this season's going to unfold. Is each episode builds on the last. You know, it's this laying the groundwork to understand sort of the phenomena that we found ourselves studying and researching. So second episode involves a mysterious figure named James Shelby Downer Jr., which some people may be familiar with. Yeah. If they've read any of Apocalypse Culture that was published by Adam Parfrey, I think, you know, a lot of people will be familiar with him. Yeah. Feral House. Yeah, exactly. And so, you know, that episode is definitely a little bit more, it's definitely the most controversial piece that I've put out, right?
There's some controversial characters, man. Some really heavy controversial ideas.
Yeah. And so, I'm not saying I'm nervous about things like that. With all of this, I try to approach it with very kit gloves, you know.
Sure.
I tried not to, definitely be defamatory or say anything. But, you know, at the same time, I still needed to address the issues of those people, you know. And if you've listened to the episode, you know, I'm not going to name anybody, but definitely it's one of those things that I didn't expect to be delving into. And it's, you know, there are two more episodes that sort of go deeper into this. But, you know,
wow,
I think it's important to talk about some of this stuff, you know.
So you said that, you know, after, you know, posting these last two episodes, there's already been a little bit of a unique reaction that you may have not been expecting. What was that then?
There are some individuals that are Holocaust revisionists, I guess they refer to themselves as, and some people that are involved in, you know, in the 1970s and 80s historically that were in the sort of, you know, you don't want to say people that were Nazis, but, you know, white National Socialist Party, 1970. So it deals a little bit with sort of the Liberty Lobby stuff. I just found this weird intersection between a lot of extremist far right stuff in the 1970s and 1980s that intersected with the Fordian community. Especially now, you know, so
right. Well, even now, that is something that is occurring that is pretty stressful. As someone that, you know, I don't identify with any sort of sector group, but a Fordian probably I am, and it is kind of alarming the rate of individuals that were prominent within that community that have revealed themselves as like sort of super conservative or MAGA folks. It's very strange to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's been strange to me too, and especially talking to some of the guys like you know, Adam Gilrightly, or you know, Michael Hughes is in the show later. Just some of these figures that are in the Fordian community who have been there for decades, you know, and they're telling me how they've seen how they've seen things shift. But you know, I think this season is very important to me to communicate sort of where some of these ideas that because you know, a lot of the stuff that I've been looking into in terms of synchro mysticism and you know, I think because of the success of Hellier, a lot more people are into what I would call synchro mysticism, you know, synchronicities, right. and that's getting a lot of attention right now, and I think it's important to look at where some of the foundational parts of those ideas come from. You know, it's not so simple just to be like, oh, I'm into coincidences, right? Yeah. Because you know, like it's a little bit more nuanced than that. And so I really, part of it became that, but part of the season story is understanding historically how we got to this point and where a lot of this stuff came from. And really, it's just my personal research. You know, I didn't know a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
And so I've really tried to take the listener this season along for that ride, the same, you know, ride that I've been on. So.
Well, it's really funny that you bring that up, and I guess I haven't thought about it in this way, but it all makes sense because I've thought of something in relationship to sort of occult practices and magical practices in the same way, in that now because of the easy access of information for everyone, right? The lack of barriers probably that should not be there for a lot of people to gain certain information, access certain things. Right. I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but you basically have a lot of folks that when it comes to synchromysticism, synchronicities, or these very strange dark corners of the paranormal, you know, these are places that one would typically arrive after reading book after book, after newsletter, after conference. Like you really had to work to find yourself in some of these deep, dark corners, or, you know, in the early 90s, maybe it was being a part of certain Yahoo, you know, chat groups or something, or message boards. You could potentially find yourself there, but there wasn't this sort of saturation of the uninitiated that would find themselves in these places without a lot of work. And now you are seeing a lot of people that a series like Hellier, right, or even quite a bit of Euphemet, like we're kind of pulling the rug out from a lot of people, and they're falling deep very quickly.
Yeah.
And I've,
you know, it's
and I've
true,
always
it's
been
true.
Kind of concerned about that in a way.
No, I hadn't thought about that. That's true that definitely, you know, this is something that we just recently started looking at. You know, you can only find so much stuff online, especially people like Downard, right? Yeah. But we started diving into the old Usenet groups, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And people have archived alt.conspiracy. And I've never looked at that stuff. And if you do a Google search, you're not going to find anything. You've got to go into these archives, right?
Wow.
And so when you go into these archives, it's a treasure trove of weirdness, right? And I mean, there were conspiracies and I'm saying like well-researched stuff, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that like people have all the citations and these things that I've never even heard of. And so, yeah, definitely. I think there, it took a bit of work to, and hours spent digging around and sort of educating yourself and then talking to this guy. Hey, you got a copy of this? This thing's not available. You know, it's like the Sirius Rising tapes, right?
Yeah,
that we talk about.
Right. So, tape trading. Know,
dude, it took me forever to get those, right? And right now some people are like, well, why don't you just release those, or why hasn't someone released those? But it's not, you know, those are kind of things that, do you want to release that? There's a lot of of stuff on there that someone who's not taking the time to sort of build a foundation to understand some of this stuff, right? Like exactly what you were saying. It can trip them up, I think.
Right.
When they're exposed to this, because you've got to have the context. I think you have to have the context to look at some of this more esoteric stuff. You know,
we've
I mean?
Seen more than ever how unresponsible misinformation gets out there almost as of a virus and can change the course of our human narrative very quickly with BS, right?
Yeah. And that's the other thing that I really want to tackle, you know, this season, in which people will listen to, is this idea of narratives and of controlling narratives, you know, that people that are good at repurposing folklore.
Mm.
I'm not sure. Are you familiar with Hookland at all?
No. Tell us about it.
It's a Twitter account that is online out of England, and so it's a fictional county that doesn't exist, right?
Wow.
And so there's all this weird occult stuff that happens, but in that story, there's a lot of he tackles this idea of fascism stealing the local folklore. And so he's built this as a project to combat against that. And so, you know, it's just one of those things that I got into it. I started reading it, and at first, I swear, I didn't realize that it was actually not a real place at first, right? And then the deeper that I got into it, I was like, oh, okay, right, you know, and so yeah, I've just been fascinated by that because folklore is such a big part of Pennyroyal, you know, this idea of how place affects people and how people affect place. And I think the space between those two things is really where folklore emerges, right? That's where stories emerge, right. Local stories. And yeah, I think even within online communities, you know, within the Fortean community, within, you know, I mean, God, think of like UFO Twitter, you know, and right. In terms of just like these communities have emerged and they have their own folklore, mm-hmm. even online. Right. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think that we have to educate ourselves on what a significant force narrative is in our lives in terms of shaping what our reality is, because we see the world through the stories that we tell ourselves. Right. And so we have to make sure that we are in control of those stories and they're not being hijacked by someone else. You know?
Yes, exactly. And, you know, when we're starting to talk about the potentiality of some of this phenomenon being potentially participatory, right? That narrative based off influence could be influencing what that phenomenon is, then it becomes even more implicit the responsibility of helping shape that narrative with context, with grounded context, doesn't it?
Yes, that's exactly it. And so, I mean, I just think that's so important because especially right now, anyone can make a documentary, you know, anyone can,
that's for sure.
Can tell stories. Right.
Right.
And so I think there's an inherent responsibility on the part of the storyteller, mm-hmm. to his listeners, to his or her listeners. And so, yeah, especially in these communities right now, because I don't know, man, it's sort of unprecedented, I think. And it's not like things like this weren't happening back in the 1980s, but like said,
or
it's
even
just
before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, it goes all the way back. But right now, we have such incredible access to everything and anything, mm-hmm. that, we just have to. I mean, it's wonderful too, because now we can access a plethora of stories.
Yes.
That we would have never been able to, you know, that you would have had to have known someone that had had the clippings, right. You know, from a newspaper to be able to see. Now we can see all these things. And
have folks involved in it that never would have had access or the ability to be involved in it before.
Yes.
You know?
Yes. Yeah.
I mean, it no longer is the field just a bunch of white dudes standing around, you know, just to be honest, you know.
No. And that was a big thing. I think that I realized at the end of season one was that it was a bunch of white dudes talking about strange stuff, you know? And I thought, uh-huh. you know, I'm not representing any female voices in the community. You know, there just wasn't any diversity. And so really this season, the second season, I've really tried to include a wide, you know, diversity of people and just to have voices from all over the community and kind of across the spectrum politically, you know, it just was really important for me to capture a sort of a large swath of opinions and perspectives.
Much more rich does that become, that narrative, right?
It's so amazing. Much more. Yeah, that's that's the thing. I feel the first I always say this because it's kind of, I think it's kind of funny, but you know, the first Matrix film was very like focused on those characters, and then the second Matrix film was like a little bit of a wider sort of a chunk of the world, mm-hmm. and so that's what Pennyroyal feels like for me, is that the first season was very focused on us, you know, here in this town and what was happening here, and so the second season really widens out that perspective,
right.
So that it's a little bit more, you know, it becomes national. It's a national story, you know, even beyond that.
Right. Well, not to be a hater here, but I'm already enjoying the second season much more than Matrix 2. So,
right.
you have that going on. Anyway, I feel like we have a, you know, I threw out my format and my questions out the window as soon as we started talking here. And for folks that are just tuning in right now, you know, I'm talking to Nathan Paul Isaac. He is the producer, the creator, the host of Penny Royal Podcast, which explores a very strange slice of America that really is sort of this vortex or this intersection between paranormal activity and really the foundation of American conspiracy and some very strange sort of dangerous goings on. But, you know, real quick before we go to the break, can you tell me in about a minute where Penny Royal is? What are we talking about when we're talking Penny Royal,
Nathan? Okay. Yeah. So we're talking about a region in South Central Kentucky that stretches sort of from where the Appalachian Mountains are westward to about Hopkinsville, where everybody's familiar with the Hopkinsville goblins, you know.
Sure.
And so that's the western part, but it's a plateau in the central part of Kentucky. It's kind of a triangle of sorts. Yeah, I mean, geographically, we're right above the Mammoth Cave system and a bunch of other cave systems that kind of stretch across Kentucky. But it's a very unique landscape of karst and sinkholes and caverns, you know.
Well, when we come back, I'm going to ask you more about some of the strange things that occur there. I know last time you told me a little bit about Sky Falls and a meat fall that was directly by there. And we'll go a little bit in that potentially, but we'll talk about what's happening in Pulaski County and also talk about a story, something really personal that has happened to you since you started producing this work. And again, if you want to call into the podcast to ask any questions, Nathan Paul, Isaac, or of me, you can do that. And that number is 425-373-5527 or toll-free in Western Washington, 888-298-5569. That's here on Night Drift.
Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's kazoo concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's bachelorette bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
We are back here on Night Drift. If you want more of the program, you can find it on the Euphemet feed, wherever you listen to podcasts. For more information, visit euphemet.com and make sure to follow us across social media at Euphemet. And do you have a paranormal experience that has maybe changed your life, given you new perspective, something you just can't shake that you feel like you need to share? Well, you can share it with me at jim@euphemet.com, and maybe potentially you can be a feature on the program. As for tonight, you heard the call-in numbers. If you'd like to join the conversation, go ahead and give us a ring. I'm back here with Nathan Paul Isaac of the Penny Royal Podcast, talking about the series and high strangeness of Pulaski County, Kentucky. Welcome back to the show, Nathan.
Hey, Jim. Thanks, man. Thanks.
So we got heavy into philosophy there, and maybe we'll steer right back on the dusty dirt road there in Kentucky and get back to some of the other things that people are actually experiencing down in Pulaski County.
Yeah, I mean, this is that's the you know, the show initially was me looking into why this particular place experiences so much strange phenomena. Hmm. You know, it's you know, we talked about this the last time I mentioned the Kentucky anomaly. You know, that this specific county is right in the center of what NASA refers to as the Kentucky anomaly, which is the largest spike of geomagnetic energy in North America. Right. Sedona is the other, you know, other spike, and there's one in Alaska, but strangely enough, right here in Kentucky is the biggest, and they don't know why. But you know, the question that I was posing initially was, you know, there's this preponderance of UFO sightings here, cryptid sightings. People see alien big cats, lots of strange things. And people have had time slips. People have experienced gravity anomalies, because the surface gravity here is slightly different than the rest of North America because of the Kentucky anomaly.
Really?
And yeah, it really liked it. And there's a lot of stuff that you can read about this. And once I started to collect stories from people, of course, in the back of my mind was always, is this the anomaly? Is that what's causing this?
Right. How could you not at that point?
Yeah. Yeah. And so, and you wonder if it's attracting things here. There's also a very famous, meteor strike, here in 1919. Cumberland Falls meteor, and they've never recovered. They recovered a 54-pound piece of the meteor, but a piece larger than 54 pounds has never been recovered, and it's somewhere in the county. You know, it's like, wow. Did the Kentucky anomaly draw that down?
Right.
But yeah, there's tons of weird things. One of my absolute favorite stories, and this was reported to MUFON. I think it was in, 2012. I'll have to look at my notes, but it was a sighting of this large, translucent, flying manta ray.
Oh,
and right in slightly south of Somerset, in an area called Burnside. And it was a very detailed account, and the witness could see the stars through the body of this thing. But
oh my gosh.
I think, you know, Coast to Coast has had a few witnesses too. That's not the first time I've heard one of these sort of biological UFO, you know, sightings.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I think, is it Esetti or?
Esetti Ranch?
Yeah, the ranch up there. There's a sighting on that ranch. That's the first place that I'd ever heard of one of these manta ray sightings.
Crazy place that you'll need to come up and visit with me when you have a chance.
Have you been there?
I have, yeah, twice.
Is it really, really crazy?
listeners of Euphemet have probably heard this story, so I won't fully get into it here, but I'll tell you off air, you know, I had experiences there that have dramatically changed my life. I'll put it that way.
Wow.
And seen and experienced things that I just can't rationally explain, and that have really prompted a good portion of my exploratory work with Euphemet. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I mean, that's how I feel about this place. You know, this, mm-hmm. it's become that for me. You know, I moved down here as an outsider, and, you know, when I began to collect all these stories and things began to happen to me, it really, you know, it feels like home now, because it's so personal on this weird phenomena level. You know what I'm saying?
You're able to tuck into the weird there, huh?
It's weird. You know, I guess I just never, and, you know, I'm someone who I grew up and I always wanted to find mysteries. You know, I love Scooby-Doo, you know, and so having all of this sort of fall into my lap, you know, the stuff too, not to get off from the weird sightings, you know, but there's just tons of stuff. The number one thing that I probably hear from people here, you know, when I'm interviewing them here, involves these black cat sightings, these black panther sightings.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I've got hundreds of stories, you know, from people about this, and there are no melanistic black panthers north of Mexico in the United States, right? And so what are people seeing? You know, and the Daniel Boone National Forest, which is right beside Pulaski County in the eastern part of it, you know, they absolutely will not acknowledge that any of these sightings are true. But people are seeing these large 6-foot cats. But when you dive into Fortean research, right, you find all of this literature about the sightings of these large alien black cats around ancient earthworks and, you know, standing stones and things. And so here in Pulaski County, we have some of the Adena mounds, which are, you know, the Hopewell people, the Adena people. That's where a lot of these sightings happen. And sightings And some researchers have correlated this with some type of like thinning of the veil, or that, you know, it's easier for these things to cross over. But, you know, in England, you know, it's an island. There are no giant black cats native there, but people see those things like the, you know, the Beast of Exmoor, you know, all that stuff. But there's a correlation there even with these ancient earthworks. And so it's John Keel's window areas,
right?
You know, that maybe somehow there's a correlation between window areas and these regions. So,
you know, looking back, you know, I'm sure you've read a ton of Keel. You referenced him. I think a lot of his work is probably kind of a divining rod for a lot of us within this community right now that are fascinated by these type of topics, right? What do you feel like, if you had to speculate, what do you feel Keel would feel about the Pennyroyal Plateau and what you're, you know, sort of discovering about it at this point in time?
I think he would definitely be digging into it hardcore. You know, so many strange things happened when you read about the Mothman sightings. And I'm not even talking about the paranormal stuff. It was like the other things that were happening to him, the phone calls, the people parading as him, all of these things that were sort of paranoia inducing, right? That seemed to be a symptom of high strangeness, right? There's the seeing Bigfoot or seeing the UFO, but then there's, you know, after you see the UFO, you've got poltergeist activity in your house, right? Or you start receiving weird phone calls, or you start seeing these things. And it's like, what is that part of it? And digging into the Pennyroyal mystery, those things started to happen, you know, and that's what I was trying to document, is it's the weirdness and it's the way that the weirdness becomes personal. It really becomes very personal and very, it takes what you feed into it and really creates this weird feedback loop.
Right.
And where what you're giving it is changing the story, you know, and it really does make you a part of the story in a way that's so personal, it's difficult to tell people, to explain to people what it is and why it's happening. And we sound crazy. It just, you know,
right. And with that, you know, I don't know, when you feel like you're not being objective anymore, that you are becoming the case, is a precarious place to be. Because you start going like, okay, am I even grounded anymore? How do I even approach this now that I'm a part of this story, right?
It
can make one self-conscious when you're trying to tell this narrative and trying to help shape it with ultimate context. But I understand something really strange happened to you, and you were pulled in to a narrative after you were a speaker at the Newkirk's Phenomenacon.
Yeah, the second one. Yeah. This was probably, you know, a lot of strange things have happened, you know, since I started this whole investigation. But I was a speaker, and for context, prior to doing the lecture, and they were super gracious to have me as a guest, you know, can't thank them enough, especially for helping us with all this. But so I was trying to find a series of journals, which are called the Cincinnati Journal of Ceremonial Magic, right? And it's published by a group called the Bait Cabal. It was in the 1970s. They were led by a woman who went by the name Nima. And so this group, they were a Typhonian order. A lot of this stuff, I didn't know any of this. You know, I'm not a practicing magician. You know, I was really unfamiliar with a lot of the OTO stuff. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I knew who Kenneth Grant was. I obviously knew who Crowley was. But I didn't know that Kenneth Grant really did subscribe to this Lovecraftian mythos idea, right? Or this whole, like, tunnels of Set. So this group, this magical order, at the time, you know, Cincinnati is called Queen City, and then Somerset is called Little Queen City. Oh. And there's a railroad that goes from Cincinnati to Somerset. If you die within 20 feet of the railroad, there's an easement, and it's considered a murder in Cincinnati, right?
Oh,
or
wow.
A death in Cincinnati. Huh. And so there's always been this sort of, people come here to vacation. You know, this is a resort town on Lake Cumberland. And so this Bait Cabal group, they were coming to the Mount Victory area of Pulaski County and performing these rituals. And they believe that there were these non-human intelligences that existed in another dimension. And they believed that,
oh, wow.
They believed that the Edina had opened up a portal, basically, that they called the Cincinnati Vortex, over top of Daniel Boone National Forest. That's where Nima came. That's part of the county. And so they really did believe they were doing these time magic rituals to stop these beings from, you know, making an incursion into our world. So,
oh my gosh. Just, and so these people had books or guides, and obviously you want those.
yes. Yeah. Yeah. So I wanted to see if they had any references about Pulaski County or pictures, sure. You know? And so anyway, they're extremely hard to find. They're extremely expensive, but I found an esoteric book collector in Australia and I bought them, luckily. And so he said, I'll ship them to you in 2 weeks when I come up from the mine, which was strange because I was like, there's all this mine stuff, you know. But it turned out he was a scaffolder in Perth for some type of mining thing.
Oh,
it was totally normal, but I'd never heard of it before. But anyway, so I order the books. So I'm trying to finish the production on the show. I do the Phenomenacon 2 lecture. A couple days afterwards, I was working late at our studio. I came home about 3 o'clock in the morning and then fell asleep on the couch. And I was having this dream that I was in a parade and that I could see all the people lining the street, and they were at high fidelity, but there was this one thing that was like a stick person in the crowd. And I remember thinking, well, that's kind of strange. But my perspective, my consciousness kept moving with the parade. But this shape pulled my perspective back to look at it. And then, you know, I kind of pulled away and tried to continue on with the dream, and it kept pulling me back, trying to make me look at it. And that tug of war.
Oh, weird.
Yeah, it was super weird, right? I've never had anything like this happen. But the tug of war caused me to become lucid for a second and realize I'm dreaming. And sure. then I really tried not to look at it, and it was forcing me to look at it. And that finally caused me to wake up. So I sit up and, you know, the lights are on in the room, and this symbol, this stick shape, your drawn shape that I was looking at, that I thought was a stick person, is burned into my vision as if I've been staring at a light bulb.
Wow.
And it's like resting on the bridge of my nose. I start freaking out. You know, my heart's racing. I turn on all the lights in the house and turn on the TV. It took about 20 minutes for this to fade out of my vision, right?
Wow.
And I've never had anything like this happen. And again, you know, I don't perform any magic, or, you know, I'm just uneducated in that sense, you know. And so I drew the symbol, and then in the morning, I went back to sleep, finally got to sleep. I sent it to my research partner, Darian, and I was like, man, I had this weird experience. I wonder if it's like a sigil or something. And so I reached out to a friend and a fellow researcher, Marco Visconti. He's a ceremonial magician in England. And he was like, it looks like it could have been, maybe somebody was intrigued by your lecture and they wanted to know what, if you knew more, you know, or had anything you hadn't told anyone. And so maybe they were trying to use sigil magic to probe your mind or something, you know?
Interesting. And
but, you know, I don't know about that. I don't know if I subscribe to that or not, but it was an interesting thing.
Right.
But that was it. Nothing else happened. It was just a weird experience. Didn't know how to describe it. So another week and a half passed, and the books came in, the journals. And I open it up, and there's a ton of them in there. And I pull one out, and I open it up, and the page I open it to is that symbol drawn out. And the page that it's drawn on is talking about Pan and Set and this whole Pan ritual thing, and the ritual that was performed in Hellier by Greg. You know, the Nox, the Night of Pan ritual.
Oh my gosh.
Right. And I sent you those pictures.
Yeah.
And it's strange, right? It's an uncanny thing. And I wondered, was it retrocausal? Did I somehow, the shock of seeing that somehow caused me to remember it in the past? Or did those people really perform some type of vortex or time magic in this area that I've been spending time in, and somehow we were caught up in some weird, I don't know, eddy of some sort of what they were doing. I don't know. I mean, it's so strange, man. It's just another one of these strange parts of the mystery.
It's absolutely amazing what you sent me. I'll make sure to post that if that's okay with you, in the show notes when I post this up on the podcast feed.
Yeah,
because the resemblance is absolutely there. The architecture of what that design is coming from an art director who pays a lot of attention to silhouettes before creating branded designs and logos. It's as almost if that was the precursor to that final image that is seen there in that book. And how interesting to find yourself in a place where you possibly could be stuck between a magical working of sorts and this very charged place. And of course, like that you would be in the middle of a swirling time vortex there.
Yeah, that's the thing, you know, like, and some of this stuff too, you start to put it all together. And what we're talking about now seems so esoteric, but then there's these strange figures like the Guterma character, Mr. X, you know, that we found in the first season. You know, he buys this mine down here in Pulaski County, and the mine, it turns out, was owned by Vice President Spiro Agnew. And it's like, why does the Vice President of the United States own this mine at the end of the 1970s when he bought it? And then this figure's a possible Nazi intelligence agent that was tied into the JFK assassination, all this stuff. So that was the first season, and I was like, there's no way we could find something this crazy. And then during the course of producing the second season, we found this figure named Chuck Hayes. And if you Google him and go deep into all the conspiracy stuff online, there's two X-Files episodes based on this guy. It ties into Danny Casolaro and the octopus and this whole, I mean, I couldn't believe it. I thought, so that's two people that shouldn't exist. You know, they're such larger than life characters, you know, but they exist here. And it's like, were they drawn to this place because of something inherent in it? I don't know.
What is the relationship to those early spooks and these charged places? Because every time we go into the history, whether it's Point Pleasant and the surrounding area, whether it's Pulaski County, whether it's Maury Island, these same individuals keep popping up and have some sort of interaction with the narrative that is shaped. So what is going on there?
I don't know. That's because that is the thing. It's like you're in the paranormal, and then these spooks pop up. Exactly. You know, it's like the Kelly Hopkinsville thing. Yeah. That's the only time. That's the only official case that the CIA has ever sent an agent to do a report on. And they sent a stage magician, John Mulholland, the guy that wrote their book on pickpocketing and all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And so they actually sent him on behalf of the CIA to see if the goblins were some kind of, you know, I guess a Cold War trick.
Right.
You know? It's so strange, a stage magician. And then that guy shows up in the... if anyone's ever seen Wormwood, but the story of Frank Olson, you know, the LSD, the MK Ultra stuff, that same stage magician, his business card was in Frank Olson's wallet after he was thrown from the window and supposedly jumped from, you know, committed suicide. But a lot of people think he was thrown from the window. But it's like all of these people, and it's like, what is all this tied into? You know,
well, and is it going to be amazing when the individuals right now who are obsessed with this kind of UAP disclosure movement, right? The new individuals that are interested in this and maybe are not predisposed to how intertwined the history of UFOs are with American conspiracy, and that you almost can't separate the two. They're so foundational in the modern era.
Yeah, absolutely. And especially if you look at George Hunt Williamson and Adamski, right?
Yeah.
And these guys at Mount Palomar, and then Downard shows up at the same time they're there. And, you know,
really?
We found, Downard is there when Adamski's there. And that's one of the episodes that's coming up this season.
Oh, I can't wait for that one.
And did you know there was an OTO lodge on Mount Palomar where Adamski was, where these contactees, where that movement started? There's an OTO lodge there that Jack Parsons attended.
I was just going to mention, Parsons involved because he was right there in the desert?
Yes, man. And I was like, this is bizarre. There has to be a connection between, you know, George Hunt Williamson and Adamski and all of this weirdness. But George Hunt Williamson was suspected of being an intelligence agent, you know, and then he's tied into the Silver Shirts and George Rockwell and all of this right wing extremism.
Okay, so individuals that are listening right now, sorry to cut you off, Nathan. I know that, you know, after every single Night Drift, I get tons of messages now from folks, which I really am thankful for that people are responding to Night Drift. It took a little bit for people to understand like what was going on with this program because it's kind of so different from the, you know, the mainline documentary series. But I will get requests for reading lists, and people have been taking like pen to pad and like writing down names and exploring these things. As people are doing that, what would you recommend them to keep in mind while they're starting to travel down this new rabbit hole of UFO conspiracy?
The thing, right? Oh my God. The thing I would definitely tell everybody is to whatever you're finding, always try to find where that came, like keep going back, right? Because whatever you find is just the surface of it. And there's, you need to have context for all of this, right? Yeah. It's just like what we said about Adamski. If you just take Adamski and the contactees at face value, you're going to miss the underlying context, right? That's even more fascinating. And I think that's a big thing, is that you've got to go deeper with everything, you know?
Yeah. One foot in, one foot out. You know?
Yeah.
Keep in mind that all of this is a lot of tricksters involved too. Entire thing. So you don't know what is real sometimes. Well, Nathan, it was amazing chatting with you again, my friend. I would love to have you back on soon. Good luck with everything, Penny Royal. And where can people find the podcast?
It's on all the platforms. You know, Spotify looks great with the colors and everything. But our website is pennyroyalpodcast.com. We have a Patreon that folks can join too, the Liminal Lodge, if you want to help us out with the research. And thank you so much, Jim, for having me back on the show. You don't know how much I appreciate it. So.
Awesome. Thanks, man. Well, good night, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to Night Drift again. Until next time, keep looking up.
With Jim Perry on Spotify and subscribe on Apple Podcasts to receive new episodes of Night Drift automatically and gain access to all of our past episodes.